Okay, so the automatic stay is obviously the thing that everyone has heard of when you think about bankruptcy. Even those that have very little bankruptcy experience know about the automatic stay. What is it, and what do you need to be aware of? Most attorneys, in my experience, know that when a bankruptcy gets filed, the automatic stay goes into effect, which is essentially a huge brick wall that goes up around the debtor and makes it so that you can't touch them, you can't collect against them, can't take any action that would be detrimental to the bankruptcy estate. So, but your clients may not know that. If you represent smaller entities or smaller clients or individuals that maybe are financing mortgages, they, in my experience, tend to sort of thumb their nose at the automatic stay, and then they get sued. And they're, in bankruptcy, in both consumer and in business bankruptcies, the court can award punitive damages for violating the automatic stay. Willful is a fairly low standard here. It's whether you knew that a bankruptcy had been filed. So if your client knows that there's a bankruptcy and they go try to foreclose anyway, or they move forward to try to get a default judgment in state court or any number of things, that's willful. That's a willful violation, and they can get hit with some punitive damages. So, this is something when you're talking to sort of repeat clients that you have, just give them the caveat that, hey, if you see the word bankruptcy, you should immediately call me and we should talk about it. The automatic stay is super powerful for debtors. It is the thing that you're looking for when you file a bankruptcy case. It's that protection. And the courts take it very seriously, and there's very little, excusable anything. If it happens, it happens, and it's a violation. If it wasn't willful, it's still a violation of the automatic stay. It just means that maybe there you can't get punitive damages, but you can still get actual damages. So even if your client didn't know about the bankruptcy and they did something, they can still get sued for a stay violation. And can still be liable for actual damages. So it is very, very powerful, and it's something that your clients should all be aware of when you're kind of just having sit-downs with your clients. It's a great thing to just add to your checklist of things to chat with them about or remind them about.
Yeah, it's a good time for your clients to go through letters. I know sometimes there's auto letters that are going out. Those are violations of the stay. And the only other thing that I would point out is that there was a recent Supreme Court opinion that was discussing, like Veronica was talking about, it's basically a strict liability statute. You don't have to mean to violate it and still be in violation. And a lot of times people didn't mean to, or creditors didn't mean to violate it, but they would still be popped with punitive damages. So there's a Supreme Court opinion that kind of tempers that a little bit, but basically what it says is what most debtors' attorneys were already doing. It says that when somebody sends out a letter, when a debtor sends you a letter or somehow makes you aware that, hey, your client's violating the stay or you're violating the stay, once that letter goes out, after that, all actions taken after that, that's all punitive damage land. So if your client gets some sort of letter or is made aware of, that action is actually violating the stay, that is problem area and someone needs to pay attention to it.
One other thing I will mention, just if we haven't scared you enough about the automatic stay yet, is that you as the attorney can also violate the automatic stay by kind of disregarding that letter and saying, this is not that big of a deal, or kind of letting your client slide and say, I saw it, but I don't think it's a violation. You also can be personally liable for that stay violation as the attorney in that matter. So just be very, very careful.
Next up is lease rejection. This is under 11365 of the code, and it basically gives debtors the opportunity to reject leases that are burdensome on the estate. And if you can imagine, like for instance, we represented JCPenney. When JCPenney went in, there were a lot of leases that were burdensome to the estate. So they're going to take advantage of this. Usually, if it's not a non-residential lease, that's different. I'll tell you that deadline. Otherwise, it's going to be up to the date of confirmation. So they can reject it really at any time. Non-residential real property, so like the JCPenney example, that's going to be, you can reject it up to 210 days post-petition date. So after they file, 210 days. That gets extended all the time. So if your client has a lease that is part of a bankruptcy case, just make sure you're paying attention. You could object to that to the motion to extend and say, you know, we're not getting payments or we're not getting all of our payments and they're still there, there's problems with the property. You can stir some things up, but I would just pay attention because, like I said, that's going to get extended all the time. There was one other point that I had. Oh, so if something gets rejected, so debtor moves to reject lease. The order rejecting the lease means that the lease is breached, the contract's breached, the lease is rejected right before the petition date. And what that means is that it takes your clients out of the admin distribution. So they're not getting 100% anymore. They're going back into the general unsecured class, so they're going to get less. The caveat is that if your client has a lease or a property and they haven't been receiving payments, they should absolutely file an admin claim. They might have a rejection damages claim, absolutely, but you need to make sure that you protect them and file the correct claim if there's a post-petition period, because that will not be covered as part of the rejection damages.